KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law in Greensboro, North Carolina, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Today I'm excited to have on Professor Ramesh Srinivasan, who's an assistant professor in the Department of Information Studies and Designs and Media Arts at UCLA. Ramesh is a scholar in focusing primarily on new media and the interaction of new media and global cultures and communities. And we are going to be focusing today on a paper that Ramesh has written recently called Rewriting the Cultural Codes of Global New Media. One of the major focuses of Hearsay Culture, for those of you that listen regularly, is the impact of our new communication technologies on what we do with information and how we use it. And I've had a variety of guests on the show, really dating back to its inception, from Larry Lessig through people like David Weinberger to Geert Loving, Michelle Bowens, and others, Manuel Castells more recently, who focus broadly in this field. And in Ramesh's work, Ramesh takes a closer look at the assumptions around new media and how those assumptions may ultimately not completely capture or incorrectly capture the use and impact and parameters of new media in communities that aren't as well represented in society, as Ramesh refers to them in this article, among other ways, grassroots voices and perspectives. His work covers several fields, and Ramesh has a fascinating biography. He describes himself as a hybrid of an engineer, designer, social scientist, and ethnographer. And in fact, his website and the focus picture on the cover of his website at RameshSrinivasan.org is a picture of Ramesh, and he'll describe it in more detail, meeting with a community to discuss their use of new media within a village in India. And a lot of the focus of Ramesh's work, in fact, is in India, and we'll be focusing on that a bit today. So we're going to be looking at what those assumptions are, how those assumptions play out in new media, and I'm looking forward to discussing Ramesh's insights as to what we should be doing next and how we should be focusing. I've mentioned Ramesh's current appointment. Very importantly, especially for listeners on KZSU, and as you know, if you listen to my podcast, the show airs on KZSU Stanford. Ramesh is a graduate of Stanford University. He got a Bachelor of Science in Industrial Engineering at Stanford and has a Master's of Science in Media Arts and Sciences from MIT and a Doctor in Design from Harvard. But all of that is secondary to the fact that Ramesh is also a former KZSU DJ. So this is of critical importance, and I think, I'm pretty sure in saying that Ramesh, and thank you for joining us on the show today, you are the first former KZSU DJ that I've had on the show. So congratulations and welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
It's a real pleasure, Dave. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. You know, I've never asked this question to start off, but now I feel like I have to. So what was, or do you remember, your DJ name on KZSU? If you're willing to reveal it, and those names often are not revealed, but if you choose not to, I understand if you don't want to answer it.
That's the stumper of a question. I got very interested in how some college radio at that time used to, in the middle of the night, which is the first time I was, you know, when I was first given a radio show, they had me DJ from 3 to 6 in the morning on Friday night, Saturday morning. And I was really interested in how some of the rival college radio used to basically play music that sounded like a vacuum cleaner that just kind of was turned on and never really switched off for 3 hours. So I used to call myself the psychedelic vacuum cleaner.
There you go.
For just a short amount of time. And then as I started to get slotted into more and more palatable time slots for DJing, I decided I'd feel better with taking on my own personal name as my identity for the radio show. So
you were one of the. I am. When I look at the KZSU schedule, it's always funny to me how you have a variety of DJ names, and in the middle of the schedule is Dave Levine. So it looks like which is my real name.
Right.
It looks like you followed that path, although you were an actual DJ. Well, it's good to have you back on KZSU, Ravesh.
It's a pleasure.
And hopefully you'll hear from former DJs or current ones. So my standard first question, which I'll now turn to, is a question that I ask most of the guests that I start off with, which is the your background in a little more detail and how you came interested in this work.
Sure. So while I was at Stanford, apart from DJing, I was interested in industrial engineering, which is, you know, what I ended up majoring in, which, you know, sort of gave me an interest in sort of thinking about how you take social or human or cultural processes and build technologies these, right? So industrial engineering looks at social processes and then tries to build optimized engineering or technological systems that are patterned on these. But at the same time, while I was an undergrad, I was also really interested in, you know, the critical social sciences in design. I mean, that was before Stanford had a design school, which was more recent, communications and media studies and so on. So after that time, you know, as an engineer, I actually got my first job at a startup doing artificial intelligence, machine learning type of work. And that was actually in Amsterdam in the Netherlands. And in this work, we were basically trying to build systems again that were sort of intelligent in various ways that could actually try to speak for social processes, try to speak for the ways in which the mind operated. So we would build systems for a variety of different clients, including nonprofits as well as, you know, large companies like KLM, for example, the airplane company. And through all of this, even though I had grown up in different parts of the world, and I'm of Indian descent, I started to become a little bit frustrated with the ways in which we were creating technology. I thought we were often creating technology based upon certain largely engineering-derived models of how culture operates, of how society operates. Even the work in human-computer interaction was often focused on very simplistic notions of what use and usability are. And after my time in Amsterdam, I started traveling a lot, you know, just out of joy of experiencing the world and, you know, thinking about the realities and experiences that people all over the world had. And what I realized, which is, you know, I guess Anthropology 101 also could have taught me this, is that in these different cultures and environments that I was traveling in all over the world, people were actually looking at information, so to speak, looking at knowledge in very different ways. The ways in which they organized the worlds, their ethical protocols, the ways what was considered sacred versus what was considered open, these sorts of informational ideas were actually different. And in fact, what I began to understand was that culture is not just sort of a question of where one lives, but it has a lot to do with the value systems that you have, that you actually learn and you cultivate as part of your development in a different, you know, community in different parts of the world. So I kind of took those insights with me. I traveled for about 6 months after my time in Amsterdam, and I enrolled at the MIT Media Laboratory, and this was in the year 2000 and 2001. And at that time, I, like many other people, were fascinated by Nicholas Negroponte's Being Digital and, you know, the idea that there was a sort of digital future awaiting us. And I wanted to be sort of part of that conversation and be someone with my engineering background who was developing technologies that were transformed in a variety of different ways. And what I realized is that at that time, the Media Lab had become quite global, was that we had started to develop projects in these different locations around the world that were really exciting, but that the projects we actually built were actually often built in laboratories and in our own sort of, you know, offices and cubicles and in our sort of MIT engineering-oriented environments. And then we would take these systems that we would build and try to embed them in villages in India, for example. We would also try these systems out in other locations in Central America, in various parts of Africa, and so on. And what I realized at that time, because I was being sent by some of my advisors at the Media Lab to these different parts of the world, was that these technologies we were building were actually not really speaking to the realities and experiences and value systems and what I call ontologies of the actual experiences of people in these different parts of the world. So that was really eye-opening for me, that combined with my travel. And it made me sort of rethink the ways in which we design technologies, the ways we think about what technologies have what types of social and cultural purposes. And so through my doctorate in design and media studies, which happened at Harvard, I began to start to think very hard about these issues and develop projects that were based upon sort of thinking about digital culture, not in terms of just exporting technologies, but really thinking about how we build technologies with an understanding of cultural visions, cultural values, cultural ways of knowing the world, first and foremost. And I think this is such a huge issue because now we have, you know, differing estimates on it, but we have 4+ at the minimum billion people wired into mobile phones. We have, you know, a smaller number than that, but a significant number having quite, you know, based upon bandwidth issues, having pretty decent amounts of internet access. So now that this is truly a global web, it's also a cultural web. And so what are the cultural questions that allow us to think about how the web can function as a more culturally sovereign and a culturally empowering type of space that recognizes the different realities, experiences that people around the world have? So that's really what brought me to where I was. And then in 2005, right after I finished my my doctorate, UCLA hired me, and I've been sort of exploring these questions really, really directly for the last 6 years now.
So Ramesh, and I should mention that Ramesh is joining us via Skype from his home in Los Angeles, and we are recording this interview on January 27th for airing the following week. Ramesh, when you talk about your field of studies, I mentioned in the introduction that you've talked about a pretty varied background. You spent a good amount of time in your most recent article, Rewriting the Cultural Codes of Global New Media, surveying the state of scholarly literature in this area. And you mentioned a variety of people's work, including the work which may be more familiar to listeners of Hearsay Culture, but the work of people like Lawrence Lessig and Yochai Benkler and David Weinberger and many others, and Geert Loving. Where do you situate your current studies in that field? In other words, what are you looking to add to our understanding of cultural media that perhaps has not been, in your view, adequately reflected in the literature to date?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's those are all very important reference points for my work. I mean, I think we can start with, you know, sort of the work that you refer to by Lawrence Lessig or even Yochai Benkler, for example. You know, the idea that in networks emerges wealth, or that in, you know, sort of in digital culture and intellectual property, it's critical to try to open up cultural voices and cultural perspectives. I think those are things that I find very sort of resonant with my own work. However, I think when one talks about free culture, so to speak, it's very important to think about what we mean by culture, right? Especially sort of referring to in this paper that we have, you know, 4+ billion people who are actually part of this sort of cultural sharing process in the web and, you know, in our world. Mm-hmm. So that allows me sort of as a starting off point to start to think about what is the culture that's being shared in our world of ideally free culture. And then when one thinks about culture in those ways, people like Geert Loving and so on start to come up, which is actually sort of a very critical perspective in the sense that culture is not just about sort of the free sharing of information, but it's the sovereignty of the different ways in which different cultures or different communities actually talk about information, engage information, value information, speak about information, so on and so forth. So those critical perspectives of people like Geert Loving are very useful in terms of interrogating some of the discourses that emerge out of work by people like Lawrence Lessig and Jonathan Zittrain. So, and not just Jonathan Zittrain, but also folks that you mentioned earlier in the intellectual property sphere. So I think that's sort of a critical space. Now, where I actually come into the equation here is, as you mentioned earlier, Dave, I'm actually an ethnographer as well as an engineer and designer. So I actually build specific projects in different locations of the world that speak to a future of the web that actually thinks about a web where are different engaging with information, engaging with new media in ways that suit their own principles and value systems. So what I'm actually trying to do in a way is close the loop between the work on free culture on the one hand and the kind of critique of free cultural systems on the other hand. So the way I'm actually trying to do that is trying to actually build a set of systems, build a set of technologies that allow us to envision a future of the web which is not about free culture, but that is about cultural sovereignties, cultural legitimacies, multiple ways in which different cultures can come to the table of the web or come to the table of new media in ways that are actually respectful of their sort of evolving traditions and practices. So really the focus here is on bringing these two sort of spaces together in a very pragmatic and kind of a critical approach toward designing and engineering technologies. Now, David Weinberger, who's the last person you mentioned, has written, of course, the fabulous Everything is Miscellaneous book. And books like that, which actually speak more broadly about new social processes, new ways of looking kind of inductively at social patterns on the web, are very informative to me because they allow me to think about, in my projects, how I actually can build systems that recognize these sort of larger social processes that are occurring on the web. So I have very specific partnerships developed with a set of different communities involving different technologies and big social questions face that are based in different parts of the world. And that allows me to bridge these types of critical positions that sometimes don't really speak to one another. So I'm really in the interest, in the business of trying to bring things together so that we can imagine a web that is really empowering for diversity and diverse communities, but really also considers critical questions that people like Geert Lovink raise.
And, of course, I think, given what I do with the show and the range of guests I bring on, that's part of what draws me to your work. Hearsay Culture has been designed to bring communities of scholars that, in my experience anyway, we're not talking to each other much, if at all, together. And I think your work bridges that gap, which leads me to, I guess, as with that background, to a jumping off question. We're chatting with Professor Ramesh Srinivasan of UCLA on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. These assumptions that you criticize around free sharing and open networks, to summarize them, and we have some time here, but what's the core of your criticism? What is theory so far gotten wrong?
Sure. So basically, what emerges out of the West, and I think appropriately out of the West, is a critique of the locking down of culture, right? And so, we hear these very sort of oft-repeated expressions such as information wants to be, and also sort of the John Perry Barlow type of scenario. And I think there's a lot of appropriateness to that, but that actually is based upon a contrast between a sort of a corporate world which locks down information and that sort of restricts creative ways of democratizing production and sharing of information. And that's a lot of what I think Lawrence Lessig is referring to, versus a world that is sort of where, a fan anime video can be created by, a kid in Japan and then gain global appeal because of its sort of ability to actually appeal to a more universal human condition. So I think there's that sort of straw man debate that I think has been used to actually, it's basically been extrapolated into the larger debate around new media. And that's sort of a question of whether we're basically given, in my opinion, a false choice between either locking down intellectual property or making it completely, totally free, right? And that sort of Western assumption that has a historical basis of making information completely free, completely open, seems like a very desirable alternative given sort of, the recent history of locking things down and making information proprietary in various ways. And so a lot of the open source and free software movement legitimately, and I think very much I have a lot of respect for that, tries to critique those types of aims. However, the issue that I'm trying to deal with, the question of that this binary need not be the only way in which we look at the sharing of culture, at the participation by different cultures and communities in the global web. Because when one works directly with different cultures or communities around the world, from Africa to India, from Native Americans, all of whom I have sort of ethnographic experience working with, one realizes that the cultural choices in those communities are not about either locking down information in a corporate way versus making it freely available for everybody. They're much more about expressing information in culturally legitimate ways, expressing priorities in particular ways, expressing ways of making knowledge in particular ways, and in some cases, actually locking down or restricting the circulation of information in particular ways. As an example, I've been working for the last 5 to 6 years with the Zuni Native American Nation based in New Mexico, kind of near Gallup, New Mexico. And for the Zuni, the idea of information wants to be free is anathema to their culture, right? For the Zuni, that sort of discourse of information being free is actually been purposed in a way in which actually many Zuni secrets, many Zuni traditions, and actually many Zuni cultural objects have actually been taken from their lands and sort of placed in these public spectacles. The point here is not to sort of privilege a traditionalism or privilege a sort of, you know, kind of an overly guarded way of looking at culture, but to allow different cultures to come to the, you know, the playing field or the table of the internet from a perspective that is based upon their own value systems, which themselves are evolving. So, for example, if you build a site or a system that the Zuni are going to participate in or a community in India is going to participate in, but that entire system is built upon a Western logic of categorizing information or describing information, you've actually, in a way, misrepresented that community. And so the real question here is not whether information is free or it's corporate lockdown, as in the intellectual property debate, but how do we think about culture in the context of sharing information and in the context of the future of the web as we know it?
We're chatting with Ramesh Srinivasan of UCLA on KCSU-FM Stanford. So, you know, to kick around that idea in a little more detail, Ramesh, you know, so Lessig is famous for saying that when he's talking about information being free, he's saying free, but not in free as in beer, and he's made that point a number of times. It's I think one of the famous phrases he's used in the context of code. Does that not at least partially address the concern that you're raising? I mean, assuming there is a false dichotomy, and I think that the IP debate within the role within new media and content generally certainly has been at the forefront. But do those distinctions address right. any of these concerns, or are they merely again addressing the wrong problem or using the wrong language?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question, Dave. I think what's actually happening is that when we say sort of free as in free beer, I think that's, of course, starting to resolve the issues that I'm dealing with. But the question is what are the templates or the ways in which free beer, so to speak, can actually be part of a community's participation in a global web, right? So in other words, I'm getting at, so is that people in these different communities or diverse cultural groups can participate in these systems, and they should have the ability to opt in to freely participate in these systems. So in that sense, I absolutely agree with what Lessig is saying. However, freedom in itself or free participation in and of itself is not necessarily necessarily basically encoded into technologies in such a way where those communities are actually able to truly express themselves. So most what I'm getting at here is most of the technologies by which community participation can occur around technologies that have basically prefigured the ways in which communities can participate. So for example, think about like an e-governance system in India, which is a specific project that I'm working on right now. The ways in which communities, local communities, can participate in that system have already been built into the logic of these systems so that they can only participate in ways in which the government thinks about community participation, so to speak. So communities can only participate in ways in which they talk about their experiences as, or their information in ways that are highly open. They're not given the opportunity to lock down what they share versus what they don't share. So these kinds of specific examples actually dominate a lot of technologies that we have today. Or you can even think about a global web where people are allowed to participate in a crowdsourcing project, for example, but their participation has to be limited to the types of questions that are asked in the crowdsourcing project itself. So if you build technologies that looked a little more like Wikipedia, but were actually built upon very specific ways in which cultures actually talk about their experiences, speak about their value systems, then you get a lot closer to, I think, the ideal that I'm getting at, which is consistent with some of what Lawrence Lessig is saying.
With regard to the research that you've done, and we're coming up on a break here, Ramesh, so perhaps I'll ask this question and turn to a public service announcement. You've mentioned the work you've done in India, and it bears noting, and I want to talk about the fact that these concepts and these concerns are not concerns that you've developed in the abstract, but that you've experienced in your own research. And so after the break, I want to talk to you about what this research looks like and what, in fact, we have as our data set with regard to the research you've done in India. We are on KZSU-FM Stanford, and for those of you that listen to KZSU regularly, you know that KZSU is a non-profit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways that you can listen to Hearsay Culture, and indeed you have a couple of ways that you can make a donation to KZSU. The first is to email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our website at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless of what you do, I do hope that you continue to listen to the program. Ramesh, let's turn to that research itself. You talk in your paper about literally going to rural Indian villages to discuss community-created video. And this is fascinating, and I'm sure it's a topic about which many listeners are not familiar. So I think we're going to start with the basics, and I'm going to ask you, what is community-created video, and how are rural Indian villages working with this new technology?
Right. So basically, I had a sort of hypothesis that came out of some of the earlier work that I did that a lot of what actually impacts development and developmental projects has a lot to do with the ways in which different communities look at themselves and look at their own world. And a lot of that is actually established with what we think of as literacy. So what I was interested in is in villages in India, in rural parts of India, there's a pretty low percentage, low level of literacy. So a lot of development and education projects have focused on working with these communities to help them establish various forms of textual literacy, reading and writing, basically. And that is actually an extremely slow and pretty painful process that actually occurs. Because it's very slow because it takes a long time to basically shift a community away from looking at its experiences in a fairly oral way to actually moving into a more literate scenario. And so what I was interested in is, given that there's an increased proliferation of very simple technologies like mobile phones, and these are sort of simpler mobile phones, in environments such as this, I was wondering whether what is really literacy, and whether that some of the attributes of literacy could actually be approximated by using very simple technologies that have a very low barrier threshold and participation. So this would actually be, I was thinking about the technology of video in this context, because what I noticed in previous projects with communities that were not used to working with video is when they saw themselves or when they saw their worlds or when they saw their sort of experiences on video, they looked at themselves in new ways. Even myself, if I see a video created of me, I'll analyze that video, and that analysis will allow me to really think about my experiences outside of myself. So basically what a lot of anthropological work on literacy has basically uncovered is that when literacy is missing in communities, so is the ability to think outside of very ritualistic ways and the way and ways to aspire in new ways, aspire and envision one's world in new ways. So basically, based upon this analysis, I ran a comparative study in two villages that are very demographically similar, using very cheap, low-cost video cameras, even the types of video cameras that some mobile phones these days actually will have within them. And I was basically interested in looking at how in one community, how that community would actually look at its world, be able to prioritize, be able to describe its world in new ways, be able to engage in planning and development projects in sort of much more active and proactive ways. How would that be affected by the community-created use of a simple video camera versus the standard and the control of just talking about one's aspirations, one's visions, one's priorities, and so on? So in these two, so I set this up in Andhra Pradesh, India, which is sort of kind of Middle Eastern India, in two different villages, and this was a two-year study. And basically, this again relates back to the earlier argument I was making, which is if you start by looking at technology in the cultural context, you actually come up with solutions that can really enable these different types of developmental projects, instead of just looking at it in terms of the more passive level of information being free or not. So in this project, by actually focusing on this issue of authorship of video, we actually basically uncovered data that was pretty powerful. We saw that in the community that actually had access and engagement with these video cameras, they began to use these video cameras in all sorts of unexpected ways. We basically only showed them how to use the video camera in a very simple way, you know, on, off switch, no editing, nothing else. And we saw that the community with the video cameras began to use the cameras to document wrongdoings, to create evidence. They started to use the videos they would make as ways in which they could market their capacities to investors or to actually generate employment. They even started to show videos on their local television network. And in one case, they even inquired about how they could take a video and put it onto YouTube that could help popularize an issue that the community was dealing with. These things were actually really new and provocative and in a way really profound, and not sort of found out or not actually part of what usually happens when we talk with communities in very oral ways, in the standard way in which development projects actually occur. And so that was basically what was really interesting about this project. We found data that was pretty conclusive that the uses of these video cameras would generate the type of discussion and dialogue in the community that would allow it to actually build common priorities and develop consensus in ways that were not occurring in the other village. So this was a two-year study that was recently completed in India. And the argument I'm making is this is a very scalable type of approach that governments and NGOs and even corporations in some cases, if they're interested, can take toward actually working with large, diverse populations around the world. I mean, we still live in a world where nearly 50% of the world's population doesn't have a very advanced form of textual literacy.
Yeah, and I think that last point there gets to a follow-up question, which is, yes, you know, this fundamental question of whether new media is, as you put it, empowering or marginalizing grassroots voices and perspectives. Yeah, I think it's been received wisdom that as a general matter, new media, to use really banal, vague terms, has been a good thing for marginalized and grassroots communities, because at least in literature that you tend to come across in the West, it's bringing communities together and people that have similar interests. There are, of course, echo chamber effects and other effects which are negative. And yet the point that half of the population doesn't have the textual literacy that would allow it to use the technology seems to be a force opposing this idea that this has been a good thing. What's your view ultimately on new media and this effect on grassroots voices and perspectives? Sure. What has your research indicated?
I think there's no question that I agree with, you know, with what you're saying, Dave, and also with what a lot of the literature is, that new media can be very, very much an empowering tool for various forms of grassroots development, the cultivation of voices in new and powerful ways. And so the only point that, you know, getting back to what you were even asking about a half an hour ago, that I want to make is that we can't simply think about sort of information being free or passive forms of access that are being removed as the sole barrier to democratization, right? It's not just about access, but in the case of the video example, it was about authorship and literacy, right? In the case of some of my other projects, it's about actually enabling communities to design and build their own systems or actually participate in ways respectful of their own local protocols and ontologies. So the key here is really thinking about if you start with culture and you start with community and you start with the 4+ billion people in the world who are fairly new users of these new media technologies, and then you look at the technologies that we develop and how those technologies can accommodate those voices, then we actually have a world where all sorts of forms of movements that are empowering, from the project in India, which was about economic and social development, to work on political movements, to work on cultural memory and cultural heritage, which is my work with the Zuni is focused on this. You see worlds where these sorts of achievements can occur because the technologies are not being placed in the hands of communities in ways in which allow them to sort of passively access information or just author information in already created sites, but in ways that the technologies themselves speak to those cultural visions, speak to those community visions of the world. So you need to build technologies that are flexible and open enough and community-centered enough where those technologies can be appropriated by those communities. And that's actually, in a very simple way, what we were trying to do with the video camera example in India.
So we're chatting with Professor Ramesh Srinivasan of UCLA on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. This idea of appropriation, and of course it's related concept, misappropriation, is one you referred to a few times. And as you're talking about it, it reminds me of Egyptologists and others that have spent their careers attempting to reclaim artifacts that were removed from their source countries in ways which may or may not have been legitimate, but ultimately in ways that were offensive to the home cultures or the cultures that created these artifacts. Is there a parallel in the use of technology to this kind of fundamental question of being able to control and own one's cultural history?
Right. This is a great question as well. I think, obviously, one needs to understand that as information sort of migrates into networks and on the web, a social life emerges associated with that information, you know, to refer to John Seely Brown's work on the subject. However, I think a big part of kind of empowering this global and diverse participation into new media systems is actually being really careful and thoughtful about whose voices are appropriate to consider in relation to some of the sort of information that emerges from these communities that gets onto the web. So, for example, with the Egyptology example, obviously those objects emerge from a particular part of the world, and they have something to say about those objects that are very relevant. Those are very relevant insights to consider. But because those objects have moved into other sorts of worlds of expertise, archaeologists now, those objects themselves have become transnational. So now those objects can be spoken about in interesting ways by archaeologists, by curators, and so on. So the key really is to think about how you build systems that legitimate the variety of different kinds of cultural voices that actually are present to speak about those objects, for example, in this case. Similarly, with our work with the Zuni, we're looking at objects that were taken from Zuni 150 years ago that are sitting in museums all over the world. And we understand that archaeologists and curators have a lot to say about these objects, but so do the Zuni. And so we think about a future of the web again, in this case, a future of the system that allows each of those perspectives to be placed side by side in parallel with one another without actually being sort of sublimated by a system that has a particular type of logic, you know, sort of Zuni input, community input, archaeologist input, and so on. What if actually each of these perspectives were just placed as they are side by side with one another? So that's really the goal here, is thinking about appropriation as a natural phenomenon that occurs with media and with information that travels, but how do you actually think about legitimating those variety of perspectives on the object itself? And that's a lot of what we're trying to deal with.
And so in the remaining 12 minutes, and being a listener to the show, Ramesh, you know what I'm going to say now, which is this is the time where I get to the unfair questions, where time becomes an issue. But I'm asking a few of them anyway. Getting to some of those solutions, I think you talk about them in a variety of contexts. One that was of particular interest to me, and I think of interest to listeners generally, is a focus on databases. And your focus there, at least the way I read it, were on the parameters of databases and how our understanding of what a database is flawed. And I think you've referred to it a little bit here, but I'll ask you more specifically, how should we be thinking of databases in the context of these marginalized voices?
Right. I think the key, what's absolutely critical here, is if you need to build systems that are built upon sort of back-end information architectures and databases that were actually the presence of those communities is not actually sort of filtered by the logic of the databases themselves. Now, to be a little more specific, most, you know, client-server-driven systems are built upon database architectures that are actually hierarchical databases, right? So basically, the databases themselves they mirror a particular metadata model, looks at how a variety of different topics or themes are hierarchically connected with one another. So the database architecture itself is hierarchical. And what that means is that the relationship between any theme largely only falls into a relationship of inheritance, where there's a parent-child relationship between each object that exists in the database. Now, the point I'm trying to make there is if you actually look at the history of science, that actually is a sort of way of looking at knowledge, a way of looking at it, at information that actually emerges out of Western scientific ways of classifying and understanding the world. And that's not an illegitimate perspective, but that's just one cultural perspective that and if you actually take that cultural perspective of hierarchical databases and you apply that to every system that dominates the 4+ billion people in the world, you are by definition going to misrepresent the ways in which those communities are actually participating in our global media web. So the point I want to move to is actually really thinking about, you referred to David Weinberger earlier. So Weinberger makes the point, which also Clay Shirky made earlier with his work on ontologies, that actually prescripting knowledge in these database, in these hierarchical forms, is actually very inappropriate, not only to the emergent behavior on the web with tagging and so on, but in terms of speaking to these different cultures and communities. So for example, I've worked in a village in India where they have 68 different ways of talking about flooding, none of which are actually being described by the hierarchical governmental way of describing flooding that comes from the government of India. Similarly, if one works with an Aboriginal community in the, you know, in sort of remote parts of Australia, you understand that the ways in which those communities describe their land actually don't fall into the hierarchical ways in which maps are created in the Western way of creating maps. So the key here is to actually think about how you build architectures that emerge from community ontologies, community ways of describing information. How can you build a system that is open and flexible enough where it can accommodate those 68 ways of talking about flooding, or those Aboriginal ways of relating concepts with one another that may seem not really fitting in a hierarchical logic? For example, with the Aboriginal communities, they don't divide their seasons in neatly discrete ways between summer and fall and spring. Multiple seasons exist at the same time, and sometimes some part of the land is connected to some seasons, and sometimes other parts of the land are connected to other seasons. These are other architectures by which we describe information. So the real question and the real challenge that I'm trying to deal with in my work is, how do you empower systems that actually underlying ways of looking at information, those underlying ontologies? And how can you empower those to be part of our web so that those types of cultural voices and perspectives can really be a legitimate part of our global dialogue, the future of our global web?
Are you, or what is your level of optimism in being able to convince programmers, coders, that these are issues that need to be reflected in code.
Yeah. I think, you know, that the thing that's fascinating is that particularly the free software movement and the open source movement, folks within these communities are developing open-ended architectures that actually work with some of the cultural and philosophical dilemmas that I'm actually speaking about. For example, in our work with the Zuni, we've basically built a system that works with curators, archaeologists, and the Zuni that doesn't include any database at all, that any information that is shared between communities is not pre-encoded into a database or metadata logic before it's shared with that other community. So actually, if you actually talk to an open source advocate or a free software advocate to actually ask them to consider these questions, not just in terms of making information freely available, but also in terms of opening up those sources, you find a lot of interest. So some of this work that I've been doing, when I give talks or write about this, I've often attracted, you know, really well-intentioned scholars, practitioners, and software developers who are really interested in thinking about these issues. And I also think that there is sort of a big move these days in the corporate world and also in the NGO and governance world to try to think about participation in ways that are more diverse. So I think there's, you know, this is an idea whose time has come. I think technically there are a lot of solutions that exist that can actually deal with some of these dilemmas. And this is very much what our entire team is trying to focus on.
We're chatting with Professor Ramesh Srinivasan at UCLA, author of the article Rewriting the Cultural Codes of Global New Media, which I understand and I should ask, in terms of getting access to this article, Ramesh, yeah, where can listeners find your work and indeed find this article?
Sure. So my website is RameshSrinivasan.org. RameshSrinivasan, because sometimes Indian names are pretty convoluted, .org. And on this site, not only are there interviews that I participated in an interview recently with Geert Lovink, or sort of short blog posts are up there, but also there's a link to a variety of different publications. So this article is currently under review at a very good journal, but I'm going to be making a draft copy of it up and available. And certainly interested members of your audience can contact me at any time by email.
Ramesh, to close out our discussion, and we have about 4 or 5 minutes left, I do want to ask you, and you talk about this in your paper, in terms of what researchers should be focusing on in the future, you know, if you were to set up a scholarship agenda to address these concerns, what would you want researchers to be looking at and studying?
Yeah. Well, obviously, you know, a lot of the ways in which we create technologies are based upon the idea that we need to build the technology and then scale it out in particular ways. And I'm totally understanding of that. That's the logic of the laboratory. And obviously, that's the way in which governments need to operate, you know, in terms of policy, for example. However, I think there's a lot of insights that fields like ethnography, or that's more of a method, but fields like anthropology, fields like science and technology studies can give designers and media studies scholars and even engineers, you know, sort of insight into how they think about technologies that work in much more diverse regions of the world so far. So sort of as a sort of research trajectory or even as an academic trajectory or even in a laboratory, I think it's very important to hybrid teams that engage in practices like ethnography, iterative forms of design and mocking things up, and also that are teams that are very interdisciplinary and we see this happening now with some design companies like IDEO, for example, and even at Google, where they're creating heterogeneous teams that merge people who are experts in culture, people who are experts in ethnography, people who are experts in mocking things up and design, as well as scholars who think very critically and theoretically about the projects that they're building. So this kind of reflective way of creating systems, designing technologies, I think is a big part of what it's going to take to get us to all talk to one another and to get us to think about a web that's truly democratic and multicultural.
Ramesh Srinivasan, Professor at UCLA, and author of the article Rewriting the Cultural Codes of Global New Media. Ramesh, I want to thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture. I think it's been a fascinating discussion. I should mention to listeners, we are recording by Skype. There have been occasional pauses, and my apologies for that. But I think, notwithstanding that minor annoyance, this has been a great discussion. And I look forward to further work from you, Ramesh, and I look forward to following your studies, and I certainly invite you back on the show to continue the discussion down the road.
That sounds fantastic. Thank you for having me, Dave.
My pleasure. I'm very excited to mention a number of guests that are coming up in this quarter. As I've mentioned before, the air date or the weekly time that the show airs on KZSU has changed a bit, so it's on 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. Pacific time on Tuesdays this quarter, and as a result, the schedule is a little bit different than I anticipated, but nonetheless, we have a number of good guests coming on, including, and this order is will be changing a little bit in the next few days, but including in no particular order, Professor David Post of Temple University, Beasley School of Law, author of In Search of Jefferson's Moose, Notes on the State of Cyberspace. Associate Dean Michael Madison, University of Pittsburgh School of Law, who's doing fascinating work on the commons in infrastructure. Evgeny Morozov of Foreign Policy and author of The Net Delusion. Professor John Taranian of Chapman University School of Law, a guest who was on previously discussing his book Whitewashed, and will be discussing his new book Infringement Nation. Professor Andy Hiley, my colleague at Elon, discussing online sales taxation. Jamei Cassio, discussing his book Hacking the Earth, and Professor Jennifer Urban, the director of Samuelson Law, Technology, and Public Policy Clinic at UC Berkeley School of Law. In the following quarter, and this quarter ends in mid-March, and then new shows won't air for a few weeks, and we'll pick up beginning in April. I'm looking forward to having on several guests, including Professor Shiva Vaidyanathan of the University of Virginia, author of the book, which has just come out, The Googleization of Everything, Professor Dan Hunter of New York Law School, Professor Dan Solov of George Washington University Law School, author of Nothing to Hide, The False Trade-Off Between Privacy and Security, Kevin Paulson of Wired Magazine, author of Kingpin, How One Hacker Took Over the Billion-Dollar Cybercrime Underground, Kevin Kelly of Wired Magazine as well, author of the book What Technology Wants, Adam Pennenberg of New York University, author of Viral Loop, From Facebook to Twitter, How Today's Smartest Businesses Grow Themselves, and rounding out this current list, and I'm always looking for additional guests to a book on the show, Pamela Long, author of the book Obelisk, A History, a co-author of a book that looks at the history of the obelisk, which has fascinating scientific, is a fascinating scientific history, as well as a book that she's co-authored on openness and secrecy. As always, there are a number of ways you can listen to the show. The main way and the best way is to listen live on KZSU, Tuesdays from 11 to 12, 11 a.m. To noon on Tuesdays on KZSU-FM, but you can also get the show by podcast. There's a number of ways to pick up the show on the podcast side. You can get the show by going to hearsayculture.com. You can also get the show by going to Stanford Center for Internet Society's iTunes page, where you can subscribe and not only get Hearsay Culture, but other events occurring at CIS. And you can also get the show by subscribing to the RSS feed at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. So I thank you for listening to the show today. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. I look forward to chatting with you next week. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.